Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is an agricultural economist who rebuts what he calls the food police, the anti-processing, anti-modifying proponents of local and organic food who advocate taxing junk food and soda pop and eating only locally grown organic foods. Jason Lusk is the Willard Sparks Endowed Chair in Agricultural Economics at Oklahoma State University. Now, actually, he doesn't have a problem with anyone who chooses to eat locally and eat in that way, but has a big problem with those who would compel us to eat that way through policy. He says it will lead to higher prices, more food insecurity or hunger, and food shortages. His book, The Food Police, A Well-Fed Manifesto About the Politics of Your Plate, tackles many of the assertions of writers like Michael Pollan and Mark Bittman and others, saying that while their personal decisions are fine, extending this to food policy would have devastating effects. Jason Lusk joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Jason Lusk, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
This new book, The Food Police, it's eye-opening, and it gives us a sense of where you as an agricultural economist see where a lot of the local wars and people arguing for a new way of preparing food have gone astray. Why did you write the book?
There are a couple of reasons. One is having grown up in a rural area of West Texas, I felt that when I picked up a lot of the best-selling books about food and agriculture, or I turned on popular TV shows about food, there was a really what I felt was a mischaracterization of food and agriculture. And I felt like there was room for somebody to step in and really correct the record. And as an academic economist, I really felt that a lot of the policies that were being advocated in the sort of popular writings were, according to the research, going to ultimately do more harm than good. So even as sort of my professional training, I felt like there was room for somebody to kind of step up and say, let's think more carefully about some of these policies and make sure they're going to actually have the kind of benefits we hope they do.
You know, when you read a lot of those books, they refer to our current agricultural system as corporate agriculture. As somebody growing up in West Texas, I spent some time in Western Oklahoma working on a family farm. Those are pretty far from corporate agriculture. Does that still exist, the family farm, or have they just gotten bigger?
Well, they certainly have gotten bigger, but if you look at USDA data, it remains the case that 98% of all farms in this country are family farms. And so, yeah, farms are bigger than they once were.
And they may hire people in to help work them.
Exactly, they do. But they are, by and large, like I said, 98% still family-owned and run. And that doesn't mean there aren't large food processors involved. That's certainly true. But there's still a huge amount of this food production that's done by people that care passionately about their own land and about their own children and about the safety of the food they put out.
One of the untold stories is the fact that, you know, we tend to think of farm crises, you know, like in the 1980s where you had the big foreclosure crisis and, you know, from low food prices and also overexpansion, I think, was one of the reasons. But right now, family farmers and farmers in general are doing better than they've ever have.
Yes, that's true in a lot of ways. You know, again, if you look at the data shows that by and large, farmers' incomes have been increasing. And in fact, today, the average income of a farmer exceeds that of the average U.S. household. Moreover, most farms have a lot higher net worth. So some of that's because they have to buy tractors and land and have these things. Now, I don't want to paint too rosy a picture. Farming is a difficult occupation, and they face a lot of risks due to weather and things that are uncontrollable. But again, just looking at the data, you come away with a picture of seeing that most farmers are doing okay.
Well, one of the things your book does is look at the good things that what we would call corporate agriculture or, you know, large-scale agriculture has done. And one of the things you have to look at is things like life expectancy, which, of course, that's also medical care as well. But but nutrition is a big part of that. And when you look at the world population, we've doubled almost, we'll probably triple from about 2.5 billion people in 1950, I guess, to, you know, 7+ billion in 2020, agriculture has helped feed that tripling of population.
No doubt about that. And I think sometimes, you know, in our affluence, sometimes we forget the fact that there still are a lot of really hungry people in this world. Just in the United States alone, 15% of U.S. households are what they call food insecure. It means they have a hard time finding enough food to eat. We even have today a close to a record number of people on food stamps. And then, of course, outside the United States, where big problems lie. And there you have, according to the United Nations, just under a billion people that they classify as hungry. And so being able to produce enough food for a growing world population remains a challenge. And in fact, if you look at what's happened to food prices, they were very low in the early 2000s, actually when a lot of these books were written. And you had authors saying things like, food is too cheap in this country. And again, according to the United Nations, since about 2005, food prices worldwide have increased about 200%. So it just isn't true that for a lot of the hungry people that food is too cheap. And it's a little bit, in my mind, a little elitist to kind of make that kind of argument. And I certainly don't have any problem, and I celebrate the fact that we live in an economy where people can buy more expensive food, higher quality food, food that happens to suit our tastes and preferences. But I think we also have to balance that with the idea that there are a lot of people that are hungry today, and looking out into the future, we're going to have a much larger world population, and it's going to take some technology and technological growth to keep up with that.
So what are some of the other things you consider really good about what we've done with agriculture, say, in the last 60, 70 years?
One thing I've mentioned, we incredibly have been able to keep up with a much larger population. So we've produced more food using the same amount of land. In fact, it's really incredible. We have at least twice as much food today as we did 50 years ago, but we're using less land and a whole lot less labor. And so we're using fewer inputs and getting more. I mean, that's fantastic. Also, even though people don't often feel that this is true, well, often because of the news stories they read, you know, food generally is a lot safer. We certainly have a lot more variety. Going to a grocery store, it's amazing the things that we can buy on any day in almost any grocery store in America. It's absolutely incredible. You know, our grandparents, I think, probably would have been astounded when they were our age to be able to find, you know, I don't know, Vidalia onions and jalapenos and asparagus anytime they walked into the grocery store. It's crazy. And yet we look at all that's bad and tend to forget that. I mean, I don't want to make the argument that all things are perfect and we can't, and there aren't things we can improve on. There certainly are, but I also think we need to take a balanced perspective.
Also, you know, when we think about the economies of scale, we also often think of like the large confined animal operations. There are environmental costs to those, aren't there?
Yes, there are, and those are certainly challenges that need to be dealt with. And there are a lot of regulations. The EPA has quite a large number of regulations for confined feeding operations. And so, yeah, there are certainly challenges that need to be dealt with. And again, this is another area where technology can help and innovations can help. For example, here at Oklahoma State University, we have scientists working on exactly those issues using things like anaerobic digesters. You know, how do we take this manure and do something with it that perhaps can even produce energy or produce a fertilizer and not create adverse environmental outcomes? So you're right, there are challenges, and I'm not going to deny that. But what I am arguing is that one of the best ways to deal with those challenges is through research and technological innovation.
Now, one of the things you write about in the book is, you know, when you pick up a lot of the books that look at, you know, the problems with food and advocating local food, organic food, staying away from supermarkets, staying away from processed foods, is there tends to be sort of a polemical viewpoint of those books. I think your book sort of adopts the same attitude in response to a lot of those viewpoints.
Yeah.
You're being provocative in the book.
I certainly do, yeah. You know, I'm trying to get people's attention and to write in a compelling way. So I'm an academic. I'm a professor. I write lots of academic, dry academic papers.
I don't think this would qualify, though.
No, it wouldn't. Yeah, that's right. So I don't hide my opinions in this particular book. That's right. So you're right. I mean, you know, so the question is, you know, in my writing style, have I fallen into the same trap as the people I'm criticizing? And maybe that's a fair criticism. But I'm also trying to get people to think and challenge their preconceptions a little bit, too. And as you mentioned, one of the main preconceptions I'm trying to challenge a little bit is this notion that there's a sort of romanticism of a return to nature. And if we could just return back to somehow this sort of what I think is a fictitious farming world in the 1950s, that our world would somehow be better. And I think that's, first of all, a mischaracterization of the actual history of farm production. Life on a farm in the 1950s was actually a lot of drudgery. And most of us don't want to live that way. You know, we might like to plant a little garden in the backyard, but we wouldn't want our livelihood to depend on it. So, yeah, I guess I'm attacking what I see as silly arguments with also a little bit of I'm poking them in the side a little bit and saying, come on.
So you refer to them as the food police. So what are your main arguments against the Michael Pollans, the Mark Bittmans, and Alice Waters of the world?
Twofold. One is that, you know, we should cautiously embrace food technologies, and to claim that people, so Pollan has a new book out now called Cooked, which he's saying we should all get back in the kitchen and cook. Well, that's great. Cooking can be a pleasure and a joy, but, you know, for a lot of us, we have jobs, we have children, we need to feed, and convenience is really a fantastic virtue. And it also is the case that inexpensive food is a real benefit to most consumers. And so part of what I'm pushing back on are those things, and technology can deliver those things. And, you know, the other side of it, too, is, you know, so one thing I'm not going to take issue with is, you know, a lot of these journalists and food writers, they have good food advice. And if I was wanting advice on how to find tasty food or make new flavors, they would be good people to go to. But in large part, what I'm reacting against are their policy recommendations. So I'm not going to turn to a food journalist or a chef when I want advice on how my tax dollars should be spent. And so that's really a big part of the book, is to say, let's look at what policies these folks are advocating, because they have been very influential, both in influencing culture and in politicians, and then look at what the research actually shows in terms of their policy recommendations. And again, the economic research seems to suggest that a lot of the policies they're advocating for are not going to have the kind of benefits they suggest.
I want to take something you said just a moment ago about inexpensive food, and I think of, you know, in one of our local grocery stores, there's a sack of groceries you can pick up for people who are food insecure that you can buy. And when you look through that bag, it is all inexpensive food. It's all highly processed. It seems to be, when you look through it, it looks like there's an awful lot of empty calories. Mm. And I'm wondering if that's what they're railing about, which does us no good. Or is there some good in having inexpensive food for inexpensive food's sake?
You're making a good point in one dimension, and that is, you know, I'm certainly not advocating that people eat unhealthily. That's, you know, not my argument at all. Partly what I'm advocating is people take a little bit of personal responsibility with their choices. And there is this notion that somehow healthier food has to be more expensive food. Mm-hmm. But the USDA did a study about a year ago and said that doesn't necessarily have to be true. And it kind of depends how you measure the cost of food. Sure, if you calculate the cost of food, cost per calorie, things like potato chips and processed food are going to look really cheap. But if instead you do it on a per weight basis, like a cost per pound, you know, a lot of fruits and vegetables and those things actually do quite well. And so it's not necessarily true that it's always cheaper to eat unhealthy. And I think this kind of is a bit of a broader issue that when we get to questions about policy, and you may be interested in asking me this later, but, you know, what do I suggest should be done? And, you know, a lot of the problems you just mentioned often are really tied, in my mind, with the problems of poverty. So when we look at people making unhealthy food choices, or sometimes that are obese, sometimes those are symptoms of a bigger underlying problem, and that is that people don't have an incentive to think about their future health and their future economic well-being. And so in my mind, policies that pursue economic growth and economic development would give people an incentive to think about themselves, and they think, well, if I eat healthier today, I might, you know, be able to reap some reward for that in the future, because I'm going to have better opportunities and better prospects in the future.
My guest today is Jason Lusk. He's an endowed chair in agricultural economics at Oklahoma State University, the author of The Food Police, a well-fed manifesto about the politics of your plate, in which he defends agriculture and also attacks some of the policies that are coming out of, say, your localvorism and organic foods, and not necessarily the fact that they exist, but the fact that they're often prescribing policy changes. And it's published by Crown. It's an interesting book, and he's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, one of the things you do talk about is the local foods movement, and I think your book is, again, a little polemical in against local foods, but you do make some really great points. The idea of a policy which mandates that, say, schools buy local foods as opposed to getting the best price and the best nutritious food from wherever. And you make some very powerful economic arguments. So what is your position on local foods? Because I think in one sense, you know, it was not too long ago, it was almost impossible. You had to drive out of town for 25, 30 miles and find a little roadside stand to find locally grown foods. Now there are markets, and, you know, there's nothing better than a tomato that was picked that day, and you eat it that same day.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not against local foods. What I am against are bad arguments for buying local foods. And I'm also against, as you can read in the book, policies necessarily supporting local foods. So yeah, I go to my local farmer's market. When I was a kid, I used to sit in the back of the pickup truck with my friend's dads who farmed and sold tomatoes and watermelons and cantaloupes off the back of a pickup. So yeah, there's nothing inherently wrong with local foods. And as you just mentioned, we know what's good about it. It tastes great. It, you know, fresher will also be better. So we don't need to be subsidized or advertised to know that that's good. It would be crazy to say we should subsidize fine restaurants because they taste better. And so what I try to do is to take a lot of the arguments that are made in favor of local foods and say, does the research actually support those arguments? So real briefly, I might take a few of them. One of them, a claim you often heard mentioned, is local foods are better for the environment. And the argument there is, well, they travel fewer miles. Mm-hmm. But really, when you look at the data, the environmental impacts of the transportation are a really small part of the overall picture of environmental impacts of food production. One of the most interesting studies is one that showed that if you lived in London, you'd probably be better off in terms of your environmental footprint buying lamb from New Zealand than you would buying lamb that was grown in London. And the reason is because New Zealand is just naturally endowed with all the things that make sheep rearing easy and inexpensive. And when you put lamb on a boat, it's incredibly energy efficient. I mean, you got to think about it. We had boats before we had fossil fuels. And so transportation, while it's something to worry about, is a relatively small part of the environmental impacts. And most of the environmental impacts occur where the food is produced. And so the implication of that is we want to grow food where it can be most efficiently grown. And that's one of the reasons you see, for example, corn grown in Iowa and citrus grown in Florida. And it's because those places can grow that food most efficiently because they're naturally endowed with the things that allow growing that food well. And so the argument that local foods are better for the environment, I think, rests on shaky premises. And, you know, you could take other arguments, too. For example, that it's better for the local economy. Sure, it's better for that local producer that you bought that produce from. That's not really what's in question. But the question is, what happens when Tulsa is pursuing their own local food policies? What happens to the folks over here in Stillwater? Well, they kind of lose out on a little bit of a market. When Stillwater says, well, we're going to pursue our own local food policy, now we're not going to buy from the guys over in Tulsa. You know, there's this little bit of a game that goes on, and it's not clear that on the net it works out. And moreover, I would say on the economic side of it, if you're paying more for that local product, there's extra dollars you're spending. Those dollars could have been spent doing something else. It could have been dollars spent sending your kids to piano lessons or to camp or giving to a charity. And so we can't just ask, you know, what did you get for that extra dollar? We got to ask, what else could we have spent it on, and what would the value of that have been? And so, you know, I take a number of those issues, like are local foods better for nutrition? And again, we think about school lunches. You know, if you want to give healthy food to children in an inexpensive manner, one of the best things you could do is probably use frozen or canned. In fact, a lot of the big processing facilities out in California or Florida, when they fresh pick that produce, they freeze it quickly, and it locks in all those nutrients. And actually, the nutrient content is going to be a lot higher than fresh produce that's been sitting out for a couple of days. And so, again, I don't have any problem with people going down to their local farmer's market. I do it. All I'm saying is when you advocate for that, make sure that the data is on your side and the facts are on your side.
One of the other things you're talking about is, you know, the war on obesity and from Michelle Obama having a backyard garden at the White House, which I don't see anything wrong with. I think that's sort of a good thing, you know, the fact that you're growing your own food, that gives you some insight into what the whole process is about. But you're talking about things like fat taxes, soda bans, attacking foie gras, as some states have done. What's wrong with those approaches?
One problem is, especially with regard to a lot of the fat taxes and things, is that the research shows they're not going to be very effective and they're going to be costly. So let's take a specific example, like a soda tax. Seems pretty obvious, like, right? People should be drinking less soda. Let's put a tax on it. That'll solve the problem.
Or at least sugar-free soda, so they're not drinking all these empty calories, right?
Right, exactly. But again, if you look at the research, the economic research that's done, you know, people have other substitutes. If you increase the price of sugared soda, people can say, well, I'm not going to drink that, but I might drink juice. Or actually, one study from Cornell showed that people might instead go over and drink more beer or alcohol. So it's not even clear that total calories, the intake of calories actually falls. But even when they do, the reduction in calories is pretty small. And so what you tend to find is that these kind of soda taxes have very, very small impacts on people's weight. but they do take money out of our back pocket. You know, they are effective at raising revenue. And the challenge, I think, with a lot of these kind of food taxes is they raise revenue from those people that can least afford to pay it. So poor people tend to spend a larger portion of their income on food. And so when we put taxes on food, we're taking money from the people that can least afford to pay it. And I think that's kind of bad policy. When we think about tax policy, we want policies that are progressive. In other words, we derive our tax revenue from those people that make more money, and food taxes do just the opposite. So with regard to sort of soda taxes or fat taxes, the research shows they're not going to change weight much, and they're regressive policies in the sense that they put the burden on the people that least can afford to pay it.
Further, you encouraged me to ask, of the problems in our food system, and you know, one problem is our rising obesity rates. Mm-hmm. Others is, you know, being able to reduce food insecurity, for example. Mm-hmm. What are some of your solutions? What are some of the best approaches you think we should be pursuing as opposed to policies? I remember I had a locavore on, and they were advocating a, you know, complete local 100 miles of the city, you know, everything should come from there. And, you know, you're looking at just the beef intake, that would nearly have to be all cattle ranches.
Right.
And her, so the solution was, well, we just have to eat a lot less beef.
Right, right.
So, you know, that's not going to really happen.
Well, certainly if you went to that model, you'd probably have a lot less obesity because you wouldn't have enough food to go around, I would guess.
What are your ideas?
So, the first thing to recognize is that, you know, the rise in people's weight is really a complicated issue, and to suggest that there are any silver bullets or quick fixes, I think is a bit naive. I'm not one of these guys that's come out and going to say, if you just do this, you'll have these problems, or you'll solve all these problems. As I alluded to, I think one of the big things that could be done is something that looks like it's not all that related to obesity, but again, giving people, pursuing policies that increase economic opportunities and increase economic growth, because those will give people incentives to think about their own health and their own future well-being. So I think generally a climate in which people feel like they can benefit and reap the returns from investments in their health and education are going to be ones that are going to help their weight. Now, one of the things that gets talked a lot about in the obesity issue are children. I have two children of my own, and in school lunch programs, I think is an area you sort of have a captive audience, and they're sitting there. And I one of the things I'd like to see is a bit more local control over school lunches. My father actually was a school superintendent at a couple of schools, and if people saw the federal regulations that schools had to deal with, I think they'd be absolutely shocked. It's just really a complex web of rules, and you know what I'd like to see is some return to local control over the food dollars and food budgets. And part of the reason there is I think local school districts know more about the needs of their own children. They know more about their own local resources they have available to them. And I also think there's need for, you know, with regard to children, for more exercise and physical education. I mean, in my kids' own school, they barely have 20, 30 minutes some days to have recess and to go outdoors. And a lot of the reasons for that is we have ramped up requirements for
testing, yeah. Right.
Yeah, testing and for curriculum. And, you know, those are motivated, of course, by good things, but they do have consequences. And so there seems to be a lot of tension on the food intake side and not as much attention on the energy expenditure side. And so I'd probably suggest some encouragement there. And there are a lot of creative things people are doing. There's some researchers at Cornell University that are looking at things, very inexpensive things like, you know, just redesigning cafeterias and simple things like that maybe can be done in a very cost-effective manner. And I'm certainly open to considering those kind of ideas. But what I would encourage people to do is base their changes on actual evidence that it's going to work.
And that's one of the things you really tackle in the book is the idea that, you know, things like genetically modified food, there's an awful lot of hyperbole and really unproven assertions regarding things like that are really helping reduce the amount of insecticides and pesticides that go into producing that food, because if your food's a little more resistant to insects, you don't have to use as much pesticides and insecticides in the first place.
That's right. I mean, yeah, you're right. This is an issue that gets totally blown out of proportion in people's concerns. And you'll see more conspiracy theories and all kinds of crazy stuff on this issue than almost anything else. So
haven't
you're right.
Haven't we been genetically modifying foods since we first started agricultural?
So I think the phrase I use in the book is that we've been, genetically altering plants since Adam spit the first seed on the ground. So, if you go back and look, the ancestor of modern corn was no bigger than your thumb. And so when we think about this return to nature, what century of nature are we talking about, here? The food we have today looks nothing like, what our ancestors had 5,000-10,000 years ago. So, we've always been manipulating, whether we did it on purpose or not, or consciously or not, is one thing. But certainly the animals and plants we have around us today look totally different than what was the case in the past. But, with regard to biotechnology, again, it's, you got to look at the evidence, and this is not just like obscure people. This is not Monsanto's evidence. This is evidence from the National Academy of Sciences. These are statements from, the American Medical Association, from, the best and the most well-respected scientific organizations, and the evidence from them says these products are safe. There's been no evidence that they've produced any kinds of allergens or any other adverse effects. And then again, if you look at the environmental impacts, they've reduced insecticide use. They've allowed farmers to use herbicides that are less toxic. They degrade more quickly in the environment, so they don't stick around and cause problems. And they allow farmers to adopt no-till production practices. If you can kill the weeds, you don't have to plow the ground as often. And those are all real environmental benefits. And not only that, they save farmers time and make them a little extra money. And for we food consumers, they do lower the prices of food. And it's kind of hard for us to see. And I think that's one reason for a lot of the backlash is it's not all that tangible to us to say, oh, okay, well, the food is now 5-10% less expensive than it would have been otherwise. And it's hard for us to make that link between this technology that's on the farm and what we see. But I think I'm optimistic that as we go forward, there's going to be all kinds of biotech developments where we will see more tangible benefits. And they're working on it now, for example, in Africa and other countries, to use biotechnology to breed in nutrients into staple crops like iron and vitamin A and vitamin D, things that are really missing in the diets of people in developing countries.
And that's like where you're looking at like a root culture where root staples are sort of like the main part of the diet.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So sometimes you have like sweet potatoes, for example, is a staple in a lot of parts of Africa. And if you can breed in vitamin A or vitamin C or these things, these are nutrients that are missing from people's diet. So you have things like, sounds crazy in today's modern world, but scurvy and blindness and whatever. Probably the most famous example of this that already exists is something called golden rice. And there are a lot of countries in the Asia region where there's a lot of poverty and there's a lot of nutritional deficiencies, and if you can breed in something like vitamin A into a staple crop that people are consuming, you can really reduce a lot of problems with blindness and things like that. So biotechnology has a lot of promise, and I'm not going to claim that it shouldn't. I by no means mean it shouldn't be regulated or that we shouldn't consider the risks, and there are some risks that have to be considered. But there's also a lot of benefits, and I think we should look at both sides of those.
The name of the book is The Food Police. Jason Lusk, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Jason Lusk is the Willard Sparks Endowed Chair in Agricultural Economics at Oklahoma State University. His new book is The Food Police, a well-fed manifesto about the politics of your plate. It's published by Crown. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.